Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Pardis Cabrai of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines the constitutional arguments against President Trump's executive order halting immigration from seven majority Muslim nations. Nadia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, who assesses the future of the growing Trump resistance movement and the Democratic Party's response to mass mobilization. And Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who explains why he believes the Trump administration will be an obstacle to progress on federal criminal justice reform. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On his first full day in the White House, President Donald Trump reimposed the global gag rule, which bans aid to international groups that provide abortions or abortion advocacy. Trump expanded the ban beyond family planning funding to include all global health assistance, such as HIV/AIDS and Zika funding. Currently, the United States is the most generous donor nation for reproductive health, with $575 million in aid. The Guardian newspaper reports global health campaigners are alarmed at the impact of the new gag rule that could put $9 billion in global health aid at risk. Susan Ehlers of the reproductive rights group Population Action International, or PAI, called the new Trump executive order irrational and backward. The global gag rule, sometimes called the Mexico City policy, was initiated by President Reagan in 1984 to bar U.S. funding for family planning from international aid groups if they provided information about abortions, referrals, or services. But the Trump order goes much further to include HIV/AIDS, malaria, maternal health, and child health care. PAI's Ehler insisted this is not pro-choice policy. This is a policy denying women life-saving services. It will, for example, cut off funding for groups providing HIV test kits for teenagers. The government of the Netherlands pledged to replace the lost U.S. family planning funding by creating a multinational safe abortions fund. On January 1st, Rex Tillerson resigned as CEO of ExxonMobil after working for 40 years for the oil giant in order to accept President Trump's nomination for Secretary of State. As Tillerson was testifying on Capitol Hill, a few blocks away, ExxonMobil was preparing for a federal civil trial on charges the oil company participated in human rights abuses, including murder and torture in the autonomous region of Aceh, Indonesia. The case, John Doe versus ExxonMobil, deals with complaints of abuses committed by security forces hired to protect Exxon's natural gas operations in Indonesia from 2000 to 2004. The case charges that ExxonMobil effectively privatized Indonesian army soldiers, despite the long history of those forces engaging in gross human rights abuses. Under Tillerson, ExxonMobil has fought the case for 15 years, denying not that human rights abuses took place, but rather that the company should not be liable. A federal judge rejected ExxonMobil's argument, saying the oil conglomerate's top executives exerted significant control over the security decisions made by Exxon's Indonesia affiliate. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is one in a series of human rights lawsuits against ExxonMobil under Tillerson's leadership. Other lawsuits involved human rights abuses, unsafe working conditions, investor and public fraud, destruction of the environment, climate change, and support of dictators. 5 years ago, Muslim American residents of Basking Ridge in central New Jersey sought a building permit to construct a mosque. Local zoning officials objected, saying there wasn't enough parking at the facility and it would create traffic problems. There were also a series of hostile acts, including vandalism targeting the Basking Ridge Islamic Society. After years of hearings and delays, the permit for the mosque was rejected. The decision forced local Muslims to rent out space in a community center to conduct Friday prayers. The Obama administration's Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department filed a lawsuit against the township, charging the intent of its action was to discriminate against Muslims, which violated the 2000 Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The number of federal discrimination cases involving Muslims has skyrocketed since 2010, driven by high-profile opposition to new mosques, such as Park 51 in Lower Manhattan, only blocks from the former World Trade Center destroyed in the 9/11 terrorist attack. On January 27th, Holocaust Remembrance Day, President Trump signed an executive order banning the entry of immigrants and refugees from 7 majority Muslim nations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The first week of Donald Trump's presidency has seen a succession of controversial changes to U.S. policy that have triggered protests across the nation. However, Trump's January 27th executive order, titled Protection of the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the U.S., provoked tens of thousands of people to demonstrate their opposition at airports from coast to coast. The executive order suspended entry of all refugees to the United States for 120 days, and bans travel from 7 Muslim-majority nations for 90 days, including Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. The order also blocks all refugees from Syria indefinitely and reduces the total number of refugees admitted into the U.S. during the 2017 fiscal year to 50,000, down from the previous number of 110,000. In response to Trump's executive order, the ACLU and other activist groups filed class action lawsuits challenging the president's order. Quickly, 4 federal judges issued stays, temporarily blocking enforcement of immigration restrictions. While the Trump administration denies that the order singles out Muslims, the executive action includes preferential treatment for Christians. Civil liberties attorneys have challenged Trump's executive order based on the fact that discrimination against refugees on the basis of religion is unconstitutional. Acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates, who had served as Deputy Attorney General under President Obama, refused to defend the order and was summarily fired by President Trump. Heads of state across the globe, Christian leaders, Democratic lawmakers, and 15 state attorney generals have all condemned Mr. Trump's immigration restrictions. Your reporter spoke with Center for Constitutional Rights Senior Staff Attorney Pardis Ghebrei, who examines the constitutionality of Trump's executive order, halting immigration from majority Muslim nations.
It is discriminatory. It's discriminatory by virtue of the fact that it singles out these Muslim-majority countries. This discriminatory aspect of this order is completely clear when you look at things like this carve-out it has for refugee admissions, where if you are a religious minority in a country alleging or saying that you are facing religious persecution, that may make you eligible for admission, but otherwise you would not be. So, for example, an Iraqi Christian who is facing persecution, religious persecution by virtue of their Christian faith in Iraq or Syria by ISIS, would be entitled to be considered for admission to the United States, whereas an Iraqi Muslim who is fleeing violence and war and, you know, physical harm in that way would be barred from admission. So, you know, that's what the order does. It's extremely barred. It also introduces broad new vetting procedures for anyone, any traveler to the United States. It ties one's beliefs, one's ideology to criteria that could be considered for admission. It's unclear exactly how beliefs and sort of ideology would be implemented in terms of new vetting procedures and, you know, what that would actually look like. But it asserts that as broadly as a criteria that can be considered. So it's really broad. I think, you know, when we woke up Saturday morning and heard reports, it changed things overnight, obviously, with the stroke of a pen. I mean, it was signed Friday night. Saturday morning, we woke to reports of people being pulled off planes abroad, families being separated at airports, hundreds of people being detained. By the end of Saturday, there was a federal court order staying parts of the order for people who were in transit at the time the order was signed and were being detained at airports in the United States. being told that they couldn't enter. The order was stayed with respect to some of those people, and there were massive protests. I mean, the response was overwhelming. And so I think for our feeling anyway, and my colleagues quickly went from kind of shock and just being appalled in the morning to real hopefulness at seeing just the massive public response, people turning out and saying, this is not who we are. This is not humane.
Well, Pardis, what is the strength of the argument, the constitutional argument, against the Trump administration executive order here on the suspension of immigration from these seven nations? I've heard that this could go all the way to the Supreme Court, but how much power does a president have to contravene laws on the books that prohibits discrimination based on nation of origin or religion?
Well, there is wide discretion, executive discretion and congressional discretion when it comes to the nation's borders and when it comes to immigration control. That said, no one is above the Constitution. No one is above the law. I think when you read this order, it is clearly discriminatory in its impact. It may talk about specific countries. These are Muslim majority countries. The impact, the overwhelming impact of this order is addressed to one specific faith of people. Many of those people are U.S. lawful residents with constitutional rights, and those rights must be respected. So the president has a lot of power when it comes to immigration, but no more power than the Constitution gives him. So I think, yeah, there have already, I mean, on day one, there were challenges filed in court, temporary stays issued by federal judges. Those cases are going to continue. And there are new lawsuits being developed now that we're going to see in the coming days. There's a response, you know, legally. There's also responses politically by Congress. There are bills being introduced or talked about being introduced, calling for the president to take back this order, to revoke this order. So we could see sort of its end, and we should see its end in response to pressure from different directions. But at least as to its unconstitutionality by the courts, I think, you know, already we've seen signs that federal judges view this order as violating the Constitution, at least in certain respects. And that's why these stays have been issued. I mean, they're temporary stays, but they are because judges have found that there is merit to the arguments that are being put forward. So, you know, while these are interim stays and there has to be further argument and decision, you know, on the merits fully, the initial reading of judges anyway of the arguments that have been put forward is that they have merit.
That was Center for Constitutional Rights Senior Staff Attorney Pardis Kabrai. Learn more about the constitutional arguments against Trump's executive order restricting immigration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From the very first day of the Trump presidency, massive numbers of protesters took to the streets to declare unyielding opposition to the real estate billionaire's extreme right-wing agenda. The historic Women's March on Washington and hundreds of other cities across the U.S. and abroad was the largest political protest in modern American history, challenging Trump's positions on a wide array of issues, as well as his cabinet nominees. In his first week in office, Trump signed more than a dozen executive orders, reversing many Obama administration-era policies. The orders, taken from a laundry list of Trump campaign pledges, aimed to revive the previously blocked Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines, defund sanctuary cities that protect undocumented immigrants from federal deportation, and what essentially is a temporary ban on Muslim refugees and immigrants entering the U.S. At the same time, many career civil servants who had served both Democratic and Republican presidents were forced out of their jobs in what some observers labeled a purge of personnel at government agencies deemed insufficiently loyal to Trump's agenda. Frightening to many was the president's recent promotion of his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, a white nationalist, to a permanent seat on the National Security Council, while demoting the Pentagon's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of National Intelligence. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink, author and lifelong activist and organizer. Here, Benjamin assesses the future of the growing Trump resistance movement and the Democratic Party's response to the mass mobilization.
Scott, I think the Women's March was just magnificent. There were hundreds of them around the country. And let's also remember they were happening in other countries as well, which is a great show of solidarity. And then every day of the executive orders that Trump was putting out, I'm here in Washington, and there would be these spontaneous gatherings outside the White House, sizes that we have not seen before since the height of the Iraq war protests, or maybe some of the very big environmental rallies. But, you know, during these Obama years, it's been hard to get people out to things. And now, boy, you just put something out on Facebook and you got thousands of people. I just came back from the steps of the Supreme Court where the Democrats came out to speak about the Muslim ban, and it was packed with people. I mean, you could barely find a place to stand. My point is to say that every single day in D.C., and then, of course, we can talk about the airport protests that have been just unbelievably beautiful. So this country is erupting with resistance.
And Medea, I've been reading some concern from people looking at this explosion of activism in the streets all across the country, totaling more than 4 million over this just first week of the Trump administration. Is there a danger of resistance fatigue, that this passion will die out if it's tapped into, you know, every 12 hours there's something new to protest, which I'm sure the Trump folks have a stack of both executive orders and legislation ready to go?
Certainly, there is already some resistance fatigue, and there will be a lot more of it if we have to keep going at this pace. And as you said, this is something that the Trump folks are counting on. On the other hand, I think as the weather gets nicer, we're going to see a new outbreak of Occupy-type resistance at the local level, focuses on sit-ins or takeovers of congressional offices, Senate offices. I think we're going to see big protests again around pipelines and other environmental issues. I think what's going to happen is it's not going to be D.C. focused. There will be some, like already there's a big march planned for April 29th, 100 days of the Trump administration. But we're going to see some radical stuff going on locally. And I think the airport protests are just a prelude to that.
I wanted to ask you about the Democrats. What's your analysis of how the Democratic Party has responded to the Trump agenda coming out so fast and furious here with all these very dramatic and extremist policy positions and executive orders? We've seen some U.S. senators, Democrats, voting for some of these very questionable cabinet nominees, and a lot of disappointment among activists. Do you see Democrats acting as a united front here in opposing many of these Trump agenda items? Or do they need a lot more pressure from the street to get them right with the sentiment out there of certainly what looks to be a majority of people around the country?
There's the issue of opposing Trump's nominees, and it is shameful that any Democrat would vote for any of these nominees because they're all so bad. And then there's the issue of what are the Democrats themselves going to do to clean up their house so that they become a vibrant party. And there's big divisions within the party itself. And I think we will see if Keith Ellison is able to become the chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, then I think we're going to see a real fighting party. If he doesn't, it's going to be business as usual. I was heartened to see the senators and congresspeople out on the steps of the Supreme Court today, but they should be leading the marches in their home communities when they go back home. They should be at the airports without people having to demand that they get out there and show up because of public pressure. They should be there because it's the right thing to do and what a leader does. You've seen a brand new congressperson, Pramila Jayapal from Seattle, who has been on the front lines of demonstrations, of speaking out, educating her constituency, and she is a brand new congresswoman. And you think, my goodness, you know, she is setting an example for so many of these congresspeople who have been in power for many, many years. Some of us would say too many years.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, author and lifelong activist and organizer. Learn more about the many groups and coalitions organizing in opposition to the Trump agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Criminal justice issues have so far taken a back seat to the Trump administration's early executive orders restricting the entry of immigrants and refugees, building the Mexican border wall, and the president's nomination of conservative Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. But starting with the fact that candidate Trump supported the death penalty and torture and called himself the law and order candidate, those working to reform the U.S. criminal justice system and reduce the prison and jail population of 2.2 million, are very concerned. Their worry is focused on what issues may be addressed in future executive orders or new legislation from the Republican-controlled Congress. Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project, a group which researches alternatives to the nation's prison industrial complex. He notes that in 1970, the U.S. held 300,000 prisoners, but that number grew in 2016 to 2.2 million, a sevenfold increase. In recent years, the number of inmates has declined slightly as a result of changes at the federal level and in some states. But despite the reductions, the U.S. still holds more prisoners than any other country in the world. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, who lays out some of the likely changes in direction on criminal justice policies carried out under the Obama administration these past 8 years.
We don't really know yet what the criminal justice agenda is going to look like. You know, on the one hand, we've had several years of building bipartisan support in Congress for sentencing reform. Senator Grassley, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, longtime Republican conservative, had been a leading sponsor and proud to be sponsoring a sentencing reform bill, and we saw related bills in the House. The new president, though, to the extent he has any history on these issues, he announced on the campaign trail that he's the law and order candidate. He's made some fairly vicious statements in the past, advocating for a death penalty and other harsh punishments. So we don't know how that conflict will be resolved or so. The other issue, of course, is the next Attorney General, Senator Sessions, having been nominated. Senator Sessions, in addition to all his beliefs and policies regarding immigration, other issues on criminal justice policy, he's been very much a tough-on-crime advocate for a long time. He was an opponent of the sentencing reform legislation in Congress. When it passed through the Judiciary Committee on a bipartisan vote, he was one of a number of Republicans who voted against it. He hasn't said much about what his priorities will be, but, we're not terribly optimistic at that level either. The Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department has been very aggressive and responding broadly to the tensions between law enforcement and African-American communities, developed consent decrees and been engaged in Ferguson, Baltimore, Chicago, and many other cities. Senator Sessions has made it pretty clear he's not very interested in pursuing that line of action and essentially is, a law enforcement supporter and doesn't seem like he's terribly interested in dealing with tensions in any other kinds of ways right now.
Mark Maurer, I've been hearing mention of Trump's support for private prisons. This with the backdrop of the federal government announcing last year that it is moving away from private prisons. What can you say about that move and about Trump's plans, if any, in this regard?
The federal government has been a major contractor with private prisons, but as a result of a very critical report by the Inspector General of the Justice Department regarding what happens in private prisons, and also the fact that the federal prison population has been declining. There's less need for them to contract out for those beds. Following that announcement, the stock of the major private prison companies went down 35% the next day. Then the day after the election in November, the stock of the private prison companies went up 40%. Numerous studies have documented higher levels of abuse, poor training of staff, high turnover, poor management, not to mention that they generally don't save any significant amount of money either. Now, having said that, that doesn't suggest that public prisons, whether they're federal or state, are necessarily doing a good job or avoiding those issues. Now, we haven't heard specific policy recommendations from Senator Sessions or the White House so far, but everything in the past suggests that they would be much more favorably inclined to look towards private prison operators, just part of their general belief in the private sector. So this is a very troubling development, you know, unless they have plans to dramatically increase the federal prison population. It's really uncalled for, because with the population declining, they can handle what number of people they have in prison through the regular federal prisons. So it's partly a question of ideology versus practicality and money and how they come out on all those issues.
So give me a temperature check on the issue of criminal justice reform as you see it right now.
You know, nearly 90% of the people behind bars are at the state or local level. So there's some reason for hope there. You know, a good number of states have enacted policy reforms in recent years, specifically for lower-level drug offenses, also around community supervision and how people are reentering the community. And most of those states are relatively pleased with the results that they've seen so far. So I think there's a pretty big gap between what goes on in Washington and what happens at the state level. So regardless of the rhetoric or policy at the federal level, I think there's good reason to believe that much of that reform momentum at the state level can continue in the next several years.
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Washington, D.C.-based Sentencing Project. Learn more about the criminal justice reform work of the project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.